with less and still pulled it off. All right, he said skeptically. He made a note of the locksmith's address. He reached for his jacket hanging over the chair. I rose when he did and buttoned my blazer for warmth. What about your mother? I don't think she should be left here alone. She was startled by the mere suggestion. Oh, no, I won't stay here by myself, she said emphatically. Not with that fella on the loose. What if he come back? Fine, we'll take you with us. You can wait in the car while we go about our business. And just sit there? Why not? Well, I might sit, but not unarmed. Ma, I'm not going to let you sit in the car with a loaded shotgun. Cops would come by and think we're robbing the place. I have a baseball bat. That was Frida's idea. She bought a Louisville slugger and hid it under my bed. Jesus, this Frida's a regular artilleryman. Artillery person, his mother corrected smartly. Get your coat, he said.
End of Disc 7. Disc 8.
Chapter 19. The Louisville locksmith shop was located on West Main Street in a three-story building of dark red brick, probably built in the 1930s. Ray found parking on a side street, and a brief argument ensued during which Helen refused to wait in the car as agreed. He finally gave in and let her accompany us, even though she insisted on bringing along her baseball bat. The storefront was narrow, flanked by dark stone columns. All the wood trim was painted mud brown, and the one street-facing window was papered over with hand-lettered signs that detailed the services offered. Deadbolts installed, keys fitted, locks installed and repaired, floor and wall safes installed, combinations changed. The interior was deep and narrow and consisted almost entirely of a long wooden counter, behind which I could see a variety of key-grinding machines. Row after row of keys were hung, wall to wall, floor to ceiling, arranged according to a system known only by the owner. A sliding ladder on overhead rollers apparently supplied access to keys in the shadowy upper reaches. All available space on the scuffed wooden floor was taken up by Horizon safes being offered for sale. We were the only customers in the place, and I didn't see a bookkeeper, an assistant, or an apprentice. The owner, Whitey Rydell, was about 5 feet tall and round through the middle. He wore a white dress shirt, black suspenders, and black pants. I didn't peek, but the pants looked like they'd leave a lot of ankle showing at the cuff. He had a soft, shapeless nose and big dark bags under his eyes. His hairline had receded like the tide going out, the remaining wisps of white hair sticking up in front in a curl, like a Kewpie doll's. In his habitual stance, he tended to lean forward slightly, hands on the counter, where he braced himself as if a hard wind blew. He let his eye trail across the three of us. His gaze finally settled on Helen's baseball bat.
"She coaches Little League," Ray said in response to his look. "What can I do for you?" Rydell asked.
I stepped forward and introduced myself, explaining briefly what we needed and why we needed it. He began to shake his head, pulling his mouth down the minute I mentioned a master padlock key with the M550 code stamped on one side.
"Can't do," he said.
"I haven't finished."
"Don't have to. Explanations won't make any difference. There's no such thing as a master padlock key series starting with an M."
I stared at him. Ray was standing behind me, and his mother was standing next to him. I turned to Ray. "You tell him."
"You're the one saw the key. I didn't see it. I mean, I saw it, but I didn't pay attention to any numbers."
"I remember distinctly," I said to Rydell. "You have a piece of paper? I'll show you." Clearly indulging me, he reached for a scratch pad and a pencil. I wrote the number down and pointed at it, as if that made my claim more legitimate. He didn't contradict me. He simply reached under the counter and pulled out the master padlock index.
"You find it, I'll grind it," he said.
He rested his hands on the counter, leaning his weight on his arms. I leafed through the index, feeling stubborn and perplexed. There were numerous series, some indicated by letters, some by numbers, none designated by the M I'd seen. I swear it was a master padlock key.
"I believe you."
"But how could a key show numbers that don't exist?" His mouth pulled down again, and he shrugged.
It was probably a duplicate.
What difference would that make? He reached in his pocket and pulled out a loose key.
This is the key for a padlock back there. On this side is the manufacturer. A master padlock in this case, like the key we're discussing. Did it look like this?
More or less, I said. Helen had lost interest. She'd moved over to one of the freestanding safes where she was perched wearily, leaning on her bat like a cane.
Okay, this side says master, right?
Right.
On this side, you got numbers corresponding to the particular padlock the key fits. Are you following?
He looked from me to Ray, and both of us nodded like bobbleheads.
You give me those numbers, I can look 'em up in this index and get the information I need to reproduce this key, making you a duplicate. But the duplicate isn't going to have the numbers. The duplicate's going to be a blank.
Okay, I said, drawing the word out cautiously. I couldn't think where he meant to go with this.
Okay, so the numbers you saw must have been stamped after the key was made.
I pointed to the scratch pad. You're saying someone had those numbers put on this key, I said, restating it.
Right, he said.
But why would somebody do that, I asked.
Lady, you came to me. I didn't come to you, he said.
When he smiled, I could see the discoloration in his teeth, dark around the gums.
Those numbers are gibberish if you're talking about a master padlock.
Could they be code numbers for another key manufacturer?
Possibly.
So if we figured out which manufacturer, couldn't you make me this key?
Of course, he said. The problem is, there's probably 50 manufacturers. You'd have to go through 2-3 manuals for each company, and many I don't stock. Stamp numbers or letters might also identify the key with a property or door, but there's no way to determine that from what you're telling me.
Have you ever heard of a lawless lock? He shook his head.
No such thing.
What makes you so sure? I said, irritated by his know-it-all attitude.
My father owned this company, and his father before him. We've been in business over 75 years. If there had been such a company, I'd have heard the name mentioned. It might be foreign.
I made a face, knowing there'd be no way to track that down. Is there any chance whatsoever that Lawless was in business back in the '40s and is now defunct?
Nope.
Ray put a hand on my arm.
Let's get out of here. It's okay. We're doing this by process of elimination.
Just wait, I said.
No way. You got a look on your face like you're about to bite the guy.
He turned to his mother.
Hey, Ma, we're going now.
He helped her to her feet, taking her arm on his right while he took my arm on his left. The pressure he exerted made his intentions clear. We were not going to stay and argue with a man who knew more than we did. I felt my frustration rise. There has to be some connection. I know I'm right.
Don't worry about being right. Let's worry about getting Gilbert off our backs, he said.
And then to Rydell,
thanks for your help.
He opened the door and ushered us out.
Besides, we don't need the key. Gilbert's got one.
Well, he's not going to give it back.
He might. If we can find the locks, he might cooperate. It'd be in his best interests.
But what are the numbers for? I mean, M550 has to be a code, doesn't it? If not for a key, then something else.
Quit worrying, he said.
I do worry. Gilbert's going to want answers. You said so yourself. Out on the street, it was surprisingly dark. The late afternoon wind whipped off the Ohio River, which I gathered was only 3 or 4 blocks away. A few isolated snowflakes sailed by. Street lights had come on. Most of the businesses along Main were closing down, and building after building showed a blank face. The buildings were largely brick, 5 and 6 stories high, the ornamentation suggesting vintage architecture. Several ground-level stores had retracting metal gates, now padlocked across the front. An occasional dim light might be visible in the deep interior, but for the most part, a chilling dark contributed to the overall look of abandonment along the street. Traffic in this part of town was thinning. The downtown itself, visible to the east, displayed a lighted skyline of 20- to 30-story office buildings. We drove back to Helen's house, circling the block once for any sign of Gilbert. None of us knew what kind of car he was driving, but we kept an eye out, thinking we might spot him lingering in the shadows or sitting in a parked vehicle. Ray left his car in the cinder alleyway that ran behind his mother's place. We went through the backyard to the darkened rear entrance. None of us had thought about leaving lights on, so the house was pitch black. Ray went in first while Helen and I huddled on the back steps off the utility porch. Helen was still supporting herself with her baseball bat, which she'd apparently adopted as a permanent prop. All across the neighboring yards I could see the towering shapes of winter-bare trees against the light-polluted November sky. Branches rattled in the wind. I was shivering by the time he'd turned on lamps and overhead lights and let us in. We waited in the kitchen while he checked the front rooms and the unused bedroom upstairs. We'd been gone for less than an hour, but the house already seemed to smell dank with neglect. The bulb in the kitchen threw down a harsh, unflattering light. The patch of cardboard in the kitchen window showed a gap at one edge. Helen worked her way around the room from the pantry to the refrigerator, taking out items for a makeshift supper. She moved with confidence, though I could see that she was counting steps. Ray and I pitched in, saying little or nothing, all of us unconsciously waiting for the phone to ring. Helen didn't have an answering machine, so there was no point in wondering if Henry or Gilbert had called in our absence. We sat down to a meal of bacon and scrambled eggs, potatoes fried in bacon grease, leftover fried apples and onions, and homemade biscuits with homemade strawberry jam. Too bad she hadn't found a way to fry the biscuits instead of baking them. Despite the cholesterol overdose, everything we ate was exquisite. So this is what grandmothers do, I thought. I had by then abandoned any hope of getting home that day. It was still only Monday. I had all of Tuesday and Wednesday to catch a plane. In the meantime, I was tired of feeling stressed out about the issue. Why get my knickers in a twist? I'd do what I could here and be on my way. After supper, Helen settled down in her bedroom with the TV on. Ray got busy with the dishes while I cleared the kitchen table. I was in the process of wiping down the surface, moving aside the sugar bowl, the salt and pepper shakers, when I noticed the sympathy card Johnny Lee had sent. Helen had apparently left it on the table, anchored by the sugar bowl. I read the greeting again, holding it slanted against the light. Ray said, "What's that?" "The card Johnny sent. I was just checking the message inside. The verse looks like it's been typed."
"Read it to me again," he said.
"And I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Matthew chapter 16, verse 19. "Thinking of you in your hour of loss." I think this is one of those blank cards where you write in the greeting yourself.
That makes sense. If the verse was meant as a secret message, how's he going to find a card with that particular quote? He almost had to buy a blank and fill it in himself.
I stared at the Bible verse. "Maybe the M550 stands for Matthew chapter 5, verse 50, I suggested.
"Matthew 5 is the Sermon on the Mount. Doesn't have 50 verses, only 48.
He glanced at me, smiling self-consciously.
"That's the other thing I did in prison besides boning up on crime. I was part of a Bible study group on Monday nights."
"You're a man of many surprises."
"I like to think so," he said.
I turned the card over and studied the black-and-white photograph pasted on the front. The photo showed the faded image of a graveyard in snow. I picked at the loose edge, peering at the cardstock under it. The print had been glued or pasted over a standard commercial picture of the ocean at sunset. I peeled it off and checked the back, hoping for some kind of handwritten note. The print itself was 4 inches by 6, processed on regular Kodak paper, matte finish, no border. Aside from the word Kodak marching across the back, the rest was blank. "You think this is a new photograph reprinted from an old neg? Or maybe a new photo reproduced from an old one?"
"What difference does it make?"
I shrugged. "Well, I don't think a picture of the ocean at sunset tells us anything. Maybe the keys aren't related. Maybe the photo is the message and the keys are a diversionary tactic." He took the card and moved to the table, holding it to the light as I had, examining the photograph. I peeked over his shoulder. All the headstones looked old, the ornate lettering softened by rain and sanded by harsh winter snows. There were 5 shorter headstones and 3 larger monuments of the Lamb and Angel school. Even the smaller markers, probably granite or marble, were carved with bas-relief leaves and scrolls, crosses, doves. The dominant monument was a white marble obelisk, probably 12 feet tall, mounted on a granite pedestal with the name Pelisaro visible. All of the surrounding trees were mature, though barren of leaves. A thin layer of snow covered the ground. One cluster of headstones was enclosed with iron fencing, and I could see a section of stone wall to the right. "I don't suppose you recognize the place," I said. Ray shook his head.
"Could be a private graveyard, like a family plot on somebody's property."
"Looks too spread out for that. Seems like a private graveyard would be more compact and countrified. More homogeneous. Look at the headstones, the variation in sizes and styles."
"So what's this have to do with two keys? He didn't have time to dig up a coffin and bury the stash. It was the dead of winter. The ground was frozen hard."
I looked at Ray with interest. "Really? It was winter? So this might have been taken at the time?"
"Possible, I guess, but if he buried the money, he'd have needed grave-digging machinery, which I guess he could have got hold of somehow. Seems like he told me once he'd been a groundskeeper in a cemetery. He could have put the money in a mausoleum, I suppose. Anyway, what's your thinking?"
"But why a picture of this? Maybe it's the name Pelisaro. I'm just spitballing here. He might have left the money with someone by that name, in a building or business in the general vicinity of the cemetery. The Pelisaro building, Pelisaro Farms, the old Pelisaro estate," I said, wiggling my brows. Ray shook his head.
"You're barking up the wrong tree."
"Well, maybe it's something visible from here. A water tower, an outbuilding, a stone quarry. Where's the phone book? Let's look. Let's dare to be stupid. We might hit pay dirt."
"Look for what?"
"The name Pelisaro. Maybe he had a confederate." I glanced around the kitchen and spotted the residential pages sitting on the chair where he'd left them. I pulled out a chair and sat down, flipping through the white pages to the P's. There was no Pelisaro listed. Nothing even close. I said,
"Shit. Well, maybe there was a Pelisaro back in the 1940s.
We'll try the library in the morning. It can't hurt."
"We better do something fast. Gilbert's going to call any minute, and I'm not going to tell him we're off to the public library. I'd like to tell him we're onto something instead of sitting here daring to be stupid. That's the same as dead in his book."
"You're a pain, you know that? Here, try this." I reached for the yellow pages and looked up cemeteries. Approximately 20 were listed. "Take a look and tell me where these are located," I said. "If we got out a map and drew a big circle, we could probably narrow down the area. At the very least, we could check out all the cemeteries within a radius of the spot where Johnny was apprehended. Wouldn't that make sense? There couldn't be that many. Judging by the photograph, this cemetery is well established. Those graves are old. They haven't gone anywhere."
"You don't know that. Around here they move graves when they dam up a river to make a lake," he said.
"Yeah, well, if the money's underwater, we've had it," I said. "Let's operate on the assumption it's still above ground someplace. You have a map of Louisville? You can show me what's where." Ray went out to the car and came back with a big map of the southeastern United States, along with a set of strip maps and a map of Louisville.
"Compliments of AAA. Car I borrowed was well equipped," he said.
"You're too thoughtful," I said as I opened the city map. "Let's start with this first one. Where's Dixie Highway?" One by one, we worked through the cemeteries listed in the yellow pages, marking their locations on the map of Louisville. There were 4, possibly 5, within reasonable driving distance of the place where Johnny Lee had been apprehended by the police. I listed each cemetery along with the address and telephone number on a separate piece of paper.
"So now what?" he asked.
"So now, first thing tomorrow morning, we'll call each of these cemeteries and find out if they have a Pelisaro buried there."
"Assuming the cemetery's in Louisville."
"Would you quit being such a butt?" I said. "We have to assume this is relevant, or Johnny wouldn't have sent you the picture. His object was to give you information, not to fool you."
"Yeah, well, let's hope he didn't do too good a job. We might never decipher it."
By 9 o'clock, I was exhausted and began to make mewling noises about turning in. Ray seemed restless and jumpy, worried because Gilbert hadn't been in touch. "What are you going to tell him if he calls?" I asked.
"Don't know. I'll tell him something. I'd like to get him and Laura over here first thing tomorrow morning so I can see she's okay. In the meantime, let's get you settled. You look beat.
He found a couple of blankets and a pillow in the top of his mother's closet.
You better make a potty stop first. There isn't a bathroom up there.
I spent a few minutes in the bathroom and then followed Ray up. As it turned out, there wasn't much of anything else up there either. A single bed with a wood frame and a sagging spring, a bed table with one short leg, and a lamp with a 40-watt bulb and a yellowing shade. I worried briefly about bugs and then realized it was too cold up here for anything to survive.
You got everything you need?
This is fine, I said. I sat gingerly on the bed while he clumped downstairs again. I couldn't sit up straight because the eaves of the house slanted so sharply above the bed. It was bitterly cold, and the room smelled of soot. As a form of insulation, someone had layered sheets of newspaper between the mattress and the springs, and I could hear them crackle every time I moved. I lifted one corner of the mattress and did a quick check of the date. August 5th, 1962. I slept in my clothes, wrapping myself in as many layers of blankets as I could manage. By curling myself into a fetal position, I conserved whatever body heat I had left. I turned out the lamp, though I was reluctant to surrender the meager warmth thrown off by the bulb. The pillow was flat and felt faintly damp. For some time I was aware of light coming up the stairwell. I could hear noises, Ray pacing, a chair scraping back, an occasional fragment of laughter from the TV set. I'm not sure how I managed to fall asleep under the circumstances, but I must have. I woke once and turned the light on to check my watch. 2 a.m., and the lights downstairs were still on. I couldn't hear the television set, but the nighttime quiet was broken by occasional unidentifiable sounds. I wakened some time later to find the house dark and completely quiet. I was acutely aware of my bladder, but there was nothing for it except mind control. I really don't know which is worse when you sleep in someone else's house, being cold with no access to additional blankets, or having to pee with no access to the indoor plumbing. I suppose I could have tiptoed downstairs on both counts, but I was afraid Helen would think I was a burglar, and Ray would think I was coming on to him, trying to creep into his bed. I woke again at first light and lay there, feeling miserable. I closed my eyes for a while. The minute I heard someone stirring, I rolled out of bed and made a beeline for the stairs. Ray and his mother were both up. I made a detour to the bathroom, where, among other things, I brushed my teeth. When I returned to the kitchen, Ray was reading the morning paper. He hadn't had a chance to shave, and his chin was prickly with white stubble and probably felt as rough as a sidewalk. I was so accustomed to his various facial bruises, I hardly noticed them. He covered his habitual white T-shirt with a denim work shirt that he wore loose. Despite his age, he was in good shape, the definition in his upper body probably the result of hours lifting weights in prison. "Have we heard from Gilbert?" He shook his head. I sat down at the kitchen table, which Helen had set at some point the night before. Ray passed me a section of the Courier Journal. One more day together and we'd have our routines down pat, like an old married couple living with his mother. Helen, for her part, limped around the kitchen, using the bat as a cane. "Is your foot bothering you?" I asked. "My hip. I got a bruise goes from here to here," she said with satisfaction. "Let me know if I can help." Coffee was soon perking, and Helen began to busy herself frying sausage. This time she outdid herself, fixing each of us a dish she called a one-eyed jack, in which an egg is fried in a hole cut in the middle of a piece of fried bread. Ray put ketchup on his, but I didn't have the nerve. After breakfast, I hit the phone, making a quick call to the 5 cemeteries we'd put on our list. Each time I claimed I was an amateur genealogist tracking my family history in the area. Not that anybody cared. All were non-denominational facilities with burial plots available for purchase. On the 4th call, the woman in the sales office checked her records and found a Pelissaro. I got directions to the place and then tried the last cemetery on the off chance a second Pelissaro was buried in the area. There was only one. Ray and I exchanged a look. He said, "I hope you're right about this." "Look at it this way. What else do we have?"
"Yeah."
I excused myself and headed for the shower. The phone rang while I was in the process of rinsing my hair. I could hear it through the wall. a shrill counterpoint to the drumming of the water, the last of the shampoo bubbles streaming down my frame. In the bedroom, Ray answered the phone, and his voice rumbled briefly. I cut my routine short, turned the water off, dried myself, and threw my clothes on. At least I had no problems deciding what to wear. By the time I reached the kitchen, Ray was in motion, putting together an assortment of tools, some of which he brought in from a small shed in the backyard. He'd found a couple of shovels, a length of rope, a pair of tin snips, pliers, a bolt cutter, a hammer, a hasp, an ancient-looking hand drill, and two wrenches.
"Gilbert's on his way over with Laura. I don't know what we're up against. We may have to dig up a coffin, so I thought we'd better be prepared."
The Colt was sitting on the tin pull-out counter of the East Lake. Ray picked it up in passing and tucked it in the waistband of his pants again.
"What's that for?" "He's not going to catch me off guard again."
I wanted to protest, but I could see his point. My anxiety was rising. My chest felt tight, and something in my stomach seemed to squeeze and release, sending little ripples of fear up and down my frame. I teetered precariously between the urge to flee and an inordinate curiosity about what would happen next. What was I thinking? That I could affect the end result? Perhaps. Mostly, having come this far, I had to see it through. Chapter 20. The Last Chapter. Gilbert and Laura arrived within the hour with the canvas duffel in tow, probably packed with $8,000 in cash. Gilbert was wearing his Stetson again, perhaps hoping to enhance his tough-guy image now that he'd been bested by an 85-year-old blind woman. Laura was clearly exhausted. Her skin looked bleached, residual bruises casting pale green and yellow shadows along her jaw. Against the pallor of her complexion, her dark auburn hair seemed harsh and artificial, too stark a contrast to the drained look of her cheeks. I could see now that her eyes were the same hazel as Ray's, the dimple in her chin a match for his. Her clothes looked slept in. She was back in the outfit I'd first seen her wearing. Oversized pale blue denim dress with short sleeves, a long-sleeved white T-shirt worn under it, red and white striped tights, and high-topped red tennis shoes. The belly harness was gone, and the effect was odd, as if she'd suddenly dropped weight in the wake of some devastating illness. Gilbert seemed tense. His face was still pockmarked with spots where Helen's birdshot had nicked him, and he wore a piece of adhesive tape across his earlobe. Aside from the evidence of first aid, his blue jeans looked pressed, his boots polished. He wore a clean, white, western-cut shirt with a leather vest and a bolo tie. The outfit was an affectation, as I guessed he'd been west of the Mississippi only once, and that not much more than a week ago. At the sight of her grandmother, Laura started to cross the room, but Gilbert snapped his fingers, and like a dog, she heeled. He put his left hand on the back of her neck and murmured something in her ear. Laura looked miserable, but offered no resistance. Gilbert's attention was diverted by the sight of his gun in the waistband of Ray's pants.
"Hey, Ray, you want to give that back?"
"I want the keys first," Ray said.
"Let's don't get into any bullshit argument," Gilbert said.
His right hand came up to Laura's throat, and with a flick the blade jutted out of the knife he'd palmed. The point pierced her skin, and the gasp she emitted was filled with surprise and pain.
"Daddy?"
Ray saw the trickle of blood and the absolute stillness with which he stood. He glanced down at his waistband where the Colt was tucked. He took the gun out and held it toward Gilbert, butt first.
"Here, take the fucking thing. Get the blade off her neck."
Gilbert studied him, easing the point back almost imperceptibly. Laura didn't move. I could see the blood begin to saturate the neck of her T-shirt. Tears trickled down her cheeks. Ray motioned impatiently.
"Come on, take the gun. Just get the knife away from her throat."
Gilbert pressed a button on the knife handle, retracting the blade. Laura put her hand against the wound and looked at her bloody fingertips. She moved to a kitchen chair and sat down, her face drained of any remaining color. Gilbert switched the knife to his left hand and reached over to take the gun with his right. He checked the magazine, which was fully loaded, and then tucked the gun in his waistband, hammer cocked and safety on. He seemed to relax once the gun was back in his possession.
"We gotta trust each other, right? Soon as I have my share of the money, she goes with you and we're done. That's the deal, Ray said.
It was clear he was fuming, a response not lost on Gilbert.
Bygones be bygones. We can shake on it, Gilbert said.
He held his hand out. Ray looked at it briefly, and then the two shook hands.
Let's get on with this and no funny business.
Gilbert's smile was bland.
I don't need funny business as long as I have her.
Laura had watched the exchange with a mixture of horror and disbelief.
What are you doing? Why'd you give him the gun? She said to Ray. You really think he'll keep his word?
Gilbert's expression never changed.
Stay out of this, babe.
Her tone was tinged with outrage, her eyes filled with betrayal.
He's not going to split the money. Are you crazy? Just tell him where it is and let's get out of here before he kills me.
Hey, Ray said. This is business, okay? I spent 40 years in the joint for this money, and I'm not backing off because you got problems with the guy. Where were you all these years? I know where I was. Where were you? You come along expecting me to bail you out. Well, I'm bailing, okay? So why don't you back off and let me do it my way?
Daddy, help me. You have to help.
I am. I'm buying your life, and it don't come cheap. My deal is with him, so butt out of this.
Laura's face took on a stony cast, and she stared down at the ground, her jaw set. Gilbert seemed to enjoy the fact that she'd been rebuffed. He moved as if to touch her, but she batted his hand away. Gilbert smiled to himself and sent a wink in my direction. I didn't trust any of them, and it was making my stomach hurt. I looked on while Ray laid out the game plan, filling Gilbert in on the calls we'd made and the reasoning behind them. I noticed he'd left out a few pertinent facts, like the name of the cemetery and the name of the monument.
We haven't found the money yet, but we're getting close. You expect a benefit, you might as well pitch in here and help,
Ray said, his eyes dead with loathing. A chilly smile passed between them, full of promises. I looked from one to the other, hoping fervently I wouldn't be around if the two of them ever got into a pissing contest.
Ray said, I assume you got the keys with you.
Gilbert pulled them from his pocket, displayed them briefly, hooked together on a ring, and then tucked them away again. Without another word, Ray began to gather up some of the equipment he'd assembled. The rope, the two shovels, the bolt cutters.
Everybody grab something and let's go, he said. We can stick all this stuff in the trunk.
Gilbert picked up the hand drill, taking his time about it so it wouldn't look like he was obeying orders.
One more thing. I want the old lady with us.
I'm not going anywhere with you, bub,
Helen snapped. She sat down in her chair and leaned stubbornly on her bat. Ray paused.
What's she got to do with it? We leave anyone behind. How do I know they aren't dialing the old 911?
Gilbert said to Ray, ignoring the old woman.
Ray said, Come on, she wouldn't do that.
Oh, yes, I would, she said promptly.
Gilbert stared at Ray.
You see that? Old woman's crazy as a bedbug. She goes too, or it's all off. What are you talking about? That's bullshit. You gonna forfeit the dough?
Gilbert smiled, still gripping Laura's neck. He gave her head a shake.
I don't have to forfeit anything. You're the one going to lose.
Ray closed his eyes and then opened them.
Jesus. Get your coat, Ma. You're coming with us. I'm sorry to have to do this.
Helen's gaze moved vaguely from Gilbert to Ray.
It's all right, son. I'll go if you insist.
Since Gilbert didn't trust any of us, we took one car. Gilbert, Helen, and Laura sat together in the back seat, the old woman holding hands with her granddaughter. Helen still had her bat, which Gilbert took note of. Sensing his gaze, Helen shook the bat in his direction.
I'm not done with you, Mama, Gilbert murmured.
Ray drove while I navigated from the front seat, tracing the route on the open map. He headed east on Portland Avenue, cutting back onto Market Street, and from there under the bridge and up onto 71 heading north. The day was breezy, faintly warmer than it had been. The sky was a wide expanse of robin's egg blue, clouding up along the horizon. I was hoping Ray would violate some minor traffic law and get us stopped by the highway patrol, but he kept the speedometer exactly at the limit, giving hand signals I hadn't seen anyone use for years. About a mile beyond the Waterson Expressway, he moved onto the Gene Snyder Freeway and took the first off-ramp. We exited onto 22, which we followed for some distance. The route we took was probably once a little used dirt road, many miles out in the country. I pictured merchants and farmers in a countrywide radius traveling hours by wagon to reach the wooded area where their dead would be laid to rest. The 12 Fountains Memorial Park was located several miles across the line into Oldham County, surrounded by limestone walls, occupying land that had once been part of a 500-acre tract of woods and tangled undergrowth. Over the years, the hilly countryside had been tamed and manicured. At the entrance, iron gates stood open, flanked by fieldstone gateposts that must have been 15 feet tall. The road split left and right, circling an arrangement of three large stone fountains, shooting staggered columns and sprays of water into the icy November air. A discreet sign directed us to the right, where a small stone building was tucked against a backdrop of cypress and weeping willows. Ray pulled onto the gravel parking pad. I could see the woman in the office peering out at us. Gilbert took Helen into the office with him. Laura's face was still so visibly bruised as to generate attention he didn't want. His own face was still peppered with tiny cuts, but nobody'd have the nerve to ask what happened. While the two of them were gone, Laura caught Ray's eye in the rearview mirror. "What about her?" she said, indicating me.
"What about her?" Ray said, annoyed.
"Gilbert's worried about Grammy calling the cops. What makes you think she won't?"
I turned around in the seat to face her.
"I'm not calling anyone. I'm just trying to get home," I said.
Laura ignored me.
"You think she's going to sit by and watch us walk away with the money?"
"We haven't even found it yet," Ray said.
"But when we do, then what?"
Ray's expression was despairing.
"Jesus, Laura, what do you want from me?"
"She's going to be trouble."
"I am not." Laura looked away from me and out the window, her mouth set. Gilbert and Helen were returning to the car. He ushered her unceremoniously into the back seat again and then got in on his side. Helen muttered something scathing, and Ray said,
"Ma, be careful."
She reached forward and touched Ray's shoulder with affection. Gilbert got in the car, slamming his door shut, handing me the pamphlet he carried with him. Since I'd called in advance, the woman in the sales office had provided us with a brochure detailing the charter and development of the memorial park. The pamphlet opened up to show a map of the cemetery with points of interest marked with an X. She'd also supplied a folded sheet of paper that showed a detailed plot map of the particular section we'd be visiting. The Pelissaro gravesite she'd circled in red. I looked back at Gilbert.
"You know, this may not lead to anything," I said.
"I hope you have a backup plan in that case."
My backup plan was to run away real fast. Ray fired up the engine again. I showed him the route, which the woman had marked in ballpoint pen. The cemetery was laid out in a series of interconnecting circles that from the air would have resembled the wedding ring design on a patchwork quilt. Roads encompassed each section, curving into one another like a succession of roundabouts. We took the first winding road to the left, as far as the Three Maidens Fountain. At the fork, we veered left, moving up past the lake, and then to the right and around to the old section of the park. The cemetery had been named for its 12 fountains, which loomed unexpectedly, wanton displays of water spewing skyward. In California, the waste of water would be subject to citation, especially in the drought years, which seemed to outnumber the rainy ones. We passed the soldiers' field where the military dead were buried, their uniform white markers as neatly lined up as a newly planted orchard. The perspective shifted with us, the vanishing point sweeping across the rows of white crosses like the beam from a lighthouse. In the older sections of the cemetery into which we drove, the mausoleums were impressive, limestone and granite structures complete with sloping cornices and Ionic pilasters. The larger sarcophagi were adorned with kneeling children, their heads bowed, stone lambs, urns, stone draperies, and Corinthian columns. There were pyramids, spires, and slender women in contemplative postures, cast bronze dogs, arches, pillars, sculpted busts of stern-looking gents, and elaborate stone vases, all interspersed with inlaid granite tablets and simple headstones of more modest dimensions. We passed grave after grave, stretching away as far as the eye could see. The headstones represented so many family relationships, the endings to so many stories. The very air felt dark, and the ground was saturated with sorrow. Every stone seemed to say, "This is a life that mattered. This marks the passing of someone we loved and will miss deeply and forever." Even the mourners were dead now, and the mourners who mourned them. The Pelissaro plot was located in a cul-de-sac. We parked and got out. Gilbert tossed his Stetson in the back seat, and the five of us moved toward the gravesite in ragtag fashion. I held the photograph at eye level, marveling at the scene that was laid out before us exactly as it looked 40 years before. The Pelissaro monument, a white marble obelisk, towered over the surrounding graves. Most of the trees in the photograph were still standing, many having grown much larger with the passage of time. As in the picture, the branches were once again barren of leaves, but this time there was no snow, and the grass had gone dormant, a patchy brown mixed with dull green. I spotted the same cluster of headstones enclosed with iron fencing, the section of stone wall to the right of us. Gilbert was already impatient. "What do we do now?" he asked Ray. Ray and I exchanged a brief look. So far, Gilbert had honored his end of the bargain. He'd showed up with Laura, who was not only alive and well, but looked as if she hadn't been battered the night before. Ray and I stood there, stalling, knowing we really didn't have a way to hold up our end. We'd tried to indicate the limits to our understanding, but Gilbert didn't have any tolerance for ambiguity. Helen waited patiently, bundled up in her coat, attentive to a large monument she probably mistook for one of us. Gilbert said, "I'm not going to dig up any monuments, especially this one. Probably weighs a couple tons." "Give me a minute," Ray said. He surveyed the scene in front of us, his gaze taking in headstones, landscape features, valleys, trees, the ring of hills beyond. I knew what he was doing because I was doing the same thing, searching for the next move in the peculiar board game we were playing. I'd half expected a water tower looming in the distance, some pivotal word painted on its circumference. I'd hoped to see an old gardener's shed or a signpost, anything to indicate where to go from here. The Pelissaro gravesite had to be important, or why bother to send the photograph? The keys might or might not be relevant, but the monument foreshadowed something, if we could just figure out what. I could see Ray doing a spot check of names on every marker within range. None of them seemed significant. I did a 360-degree turn, scanning the cul-de-sac behind us, which was ringed by mausoleums. "I got it," I said. I put a hand on Ray's arm and pointed. There were 5 mausoleums in the circle, gray limestone structures sunk into the rising hill that fanned up and around the cul-de-sac like an upturned shirt collar. Each of the 5 facades was different. One resembled a miniature cathedral, another a scaled-down version of the Parthenon. 2 looked like small bank buildings, complete with colonnades and shallow steps leading up to once impressive entrances, now sealed shut with blank concrete. On each, the family name was carved above the door in stone. Rexroth, Barton, Hartford, Williamson. It was the 5th mausoleum that caught my attention. The name above the door was Lawless. Ray snapped his fingers rapidly. "Give me the keys," he said to Gilbert, who obliged without argument. We scrambled down to the road, all of us intent on the side of the mausoleum. The entrance was protected by an iron gate with a keyhole visible even from a distance. Through the bars of the gate, a chain had been added, circling the main lock and secured with a padlock. I glanced down at the piece of paper that showed in detail the layout of burial plots in the area. The Lawless Mausoleum was located in Section M, Lot 550. The message from Johnny Lee had been sent and received. I couldn't believe we'd done it, but we'd actually managed to interpret his missive. Ray moved to the car, which we'd parked in the circle just across from the mausoleum. He opened the trunk and took out a tire iron. "Grab a tool," he said. Again, Gilbert obeyed without a murmur, arming himself with a shovel. Laura grabbed a hammer and a pickaxe Ray had found and tossed in the back at the last minute. The five of us crossed the pavement, Helen bringing up the rear with her bat tapping the pavement. We moved up the steps in an irregular grouping and peered through the iron bars of the gate. Inside, there was a paved foyer, maybe 10 feet wide and 5 feet deep. On the back wall, there were spaces for 16 vaults into which individual caskets could be placed, the vaults themselves arranged 4 rows high and 4 rows wide. We stood back and watched as Ray inserted the small key in the master padlock, which popped loose at a turn. The chain, once freed, clattered to the pavement. The big iron key turned in the gate lock with effort. The gate shrieked as it swung open, the shrill scraping sound of metal on metal. We went in. Of the 16 burial slots, all seemed to be filled. 12 bore engraved stones indicating the name of the deceased, birth and death dates, and sometimes a line of poetry. All of the birth and death dates ranged in years before the turn of the century. The 4 remaining slots were cemented over with plain concrete and bore no data at all. Ray seemed reluctant to act at first. This was, after all, a family burial place.
"I guess we better get a move on," he said.
Tentatively, he went after the uppermost square of concrete with the tire iron. After the first blow, he began to hack in earnest at the blank face, working with concentration. Gilbert took one of the shovels and used the blade in much the same way, laboring beside Ray. The noise seemed remarkably loud to me, echoing around in the confines of the mausoleum. I'm not sure anyone outside the structure could have heard much. It certainly wouldn't be easy to pinpoint the source of all the pounding. The concrete was apparently only the barest of shells, because the facing began to crack, yielding to sheer force. Once Ray had succeeded in breaking through, Gilbert chipped away at the crumbling material and widened the opening. Meanwhile, Laura was on her knees, whacking with equal vigor at the concrete facing on the bottom vault with the pickaxe. Dust flew up, filling the air with a pale, gritty cloud of small particles. There was something disturbing about the diligence with which they worked. All their conflicts and past quarrels had been set aside with the acceleration of the hunt. Discovery was imminent, and greed had displaced their contentiousness. Helen and I moved back against the wall, getting out of their way. Through the barred gate looking toward the hillside, I could see the wind pushing at the tree branches. I craned my neck, looking up with uneasiness. The sky had clouded over completely, dark forms massing above us. The weather here was changeable, where in California it seemed fixed and monotonous. I couldn't imagine where the situation was heading, and I was torn between dread and some dim hope that in the end everything would turn out all right. Ray and Gilbert would split the money, shake hands, and go about their business, freeing me to go about mine. Laura would leave Gilbert. Maybe she'd spend some time with her father and her grandmother before the three parted company. Ray would probably remain with his mother while she had her eye surgery, unless he was caught and sent back to prison first. I checked my watch. It was only 10:15 in the morning. If I managed to catch an early afternoon flight, I might get home in time for dinner. I'd missed most of the pre-wedding festivities. Tomorrow night, Wednesday, the night before the wedding, William and the boys had elected to go bowling, while Nell, Clotilda, and I would probably have supper up at Rosie's. She swore there was no need for a rehearsal dinner.
"So what's to rehearse?" "We're going to stand side by side and repeat what the judge tells us."
Nell hadn't had a chance to do the final adjustments on my bridesmaid's muumuu, but how much fitting could it need? The pounding in the mausoleum took on a repetitious rhythm. I could hear a groundsman using a leaf blower somewhere in the distance. No cars passed along the road that rimmed us. The next thing I knew, Ray, Gilbert, and Laura were dragging canvas bags out of the building and down the steps. Helen and I followed, standing by while Ray upended one of the sacks and toppled the contents out onto the asphalt. Ray was saying,
"The guy's a genius. Who the hell would have thought of this? I wish he were here. I wish he could have seen this. Look at that. Jesus, is that beautiful?"
What had tumbled onto the pavement was a hodgepodge of U.S. and foreign currency, jewelry, silver flatware and hollowware, stock certificates, coin silver, Confederate notes, bearer bonds, unidentified legal documents, coins, proof sets, stamps, and gold and silver dollars. The hillock of valuables was nearly as high as my knee, and six other canvas sacks were as crammed full as this had been. Even Helen, with her poor eyes, seemed to sense the enormity of the find. A rain spot appeared on the pavement nearby, followed by a second and a third at wide intervals. Ray looked up with surprise, holding a hand out.
"Let's get going," he said.
Laura refilled the one sack while Ray and Gilbert dragged the others to the trunk of the car and hoisted them in. When the last sack had been added, Ray slammed the trunk down. We were all in the process of getting into the car when I caught sight of Gilbert. For a moment I thought he was pausing to tuck his shirt in, but I realized what he was reaching for was the gun. Ray saw my face and glanced back at Gilbert, who stood now, feet planted, the Colt in his hand. Laura gripped Helen's arm, the two of them immobilized. I saw Laura lean down and murmur something to her grandmother, warning her what was happening, since the old woman couldn't see that well. Gilbert was watching Ray with amusement, as if the rest of us weren't present.
"I hate to tell you this, Ray, babe, but your pal Johnny was a stone killer."
Ray stared at him.
"Really? He put out a contract on Daryl McDermott and had him offed."
Ray seemed to frown.
"I thought Daryl died in an accident." "It wasn't an accident. The kid was smoked. Johnny paid a guy big money to make sure Daryl went down."
"Why? Because he ratted us out to the cops?"
"That's what Johnny said."
"So who did him?"
"Me.
Kid was all tore up about his brother anyway, so I put him out of his misery."
Ray thought about it briefly and then shrugged.
"So? I can live with that. Served him right. The fuck deserved what he got."
"Yeah, except Daryl wasn't guilty. Daryl never did a thing. Someone told Johnny a big fat fib," Gilbert said with mock regret.
"It was me told the cops. I can't believe you guys never figured that out."
"You were the snitch?"
"I'm afraid so," he said. "I mean, let's face it. I'm a rat fuck. I'm worthless. It's like that old joke about the guy saves a snake and then gets bit to death. He's all, 'Hey, why'd you do that when I saved your life?' And the snake goes, 'Listen, buddy, you knew I was a viper the first time you picked me up.'"
"Gilbert, I gotta tell you, I never mistook you for a nice guy. Not once."
Casually, Ray reached back, and when his hand came into view again, he was holding a Smith & Wesson 38 Special. Gilbert laughed.
"Fuck, a shootout. This should be fun."
"More for me than for you," Ray said.
His eyes glittered with malice, but Gilbert only seemed amused, as if he didn't consider Ray a threat he had to take seriously.
"Daddy, don't," Laura said.
I said, "Come on, guys, you don't have to do this. There's plenty of money."
"This isn't about the money," Ray said.
He wasn't looking at me. He was looking straight at Gilbert, the two of them standing no more than 10 feet apart.
"This is about a guy abusing my daughter, beating up my ex-wife. This is about Daryl and Farley, you asshole. Do we understand one another?"
"Absolutely," Gilbert said.
I felt myself backing up a step, so intent on the two men, I didn't see what Helen was doing. She brought up the baseball bat, flailing wildly in Gilbert's general direction, bashing Ray's arm on the backswing. She missed Gilbert altogether and nearly whacked me in the mouth. I could feel the wind against my lips as the bat whistled past. She hit the car on her follow-through, and the impact knocked the bat right out of her hand.
"Jesus, Ma, get out of here! Get her out of here!"
Laura screamed and ducked. I hit the ground, looking up in time to see Gilbert take aim and fire at her. There was a click. He looked down at the Colt in astonishment. He recocked and pulled the trigger. The hammer clicked again. He pulled the slide back, ejecting a round, then let it slam forward again, popping another round into the chamber. He swung the gun around and aimed at Ray. He pulled the trigger. Click. He recocked and pulled the trigger again. Click.
"What the fuck?" he said.
Ray smiled.
"Well, shame on me. I forgot to mention I shortened the firing pin."
Ray fired, and Gilbert went down with an odd sound, as if the wind had been knocked out of him. Ray moved forward easily until he was standing directly over Gilbert. He fired again. Spellbound, I stared as he fired again. Ray turned and looked in my direction. He said,
"Don't do that."
Out of the corner of my eye, I caught a blur of motion, and then I heard the crack of the baseball bat coming down on my head. In the split second before the dark descended, I flashed on Helen with regret. Her erratic batting practice had come to an abrupt halt, and she'd popped me a good one. The only problem was I could see her, and her hands were empty. Laura was the one up at bat, and I was gone, gone, gone. I spent the night in a semi-private room at a hospital called Baptist East, with the worst headache I believe I've ever had in my life. Because of the concussion, the doctor wouldn't give me any pain medication, and my vital signs were checked every 30 minutes or so. Since I wasn't permitted to sleep, I spent a tedious couple of hours being interrogated by 2 detectives from the Oldham County Sheriff's Department. The guys were nice enough, but they were naturally skeptical of the story I told. Even mildly concussed, I was lying through my teeth, cleaning up my culpability in events as I sketched them out. Finally, a call was placed to the Courier-Journal, and some poorly paid reporter checked through the back files to find an account of the bank robbery, including names of all the suspects, and a lot of colorful speculation about the missing money. As it turned out, of course, the money was still missing, as were Ray Rawson, his aged mother, and his daughter Laura, whose common-law husband was laid out in the morgue, his body perforated with bullet holes. I maintained stoutly that I'd been forced along at gunpoint, clobbered and abandoned when my usefulness ran out. Who was there to contradict me? It helped that when a call was placed to Lieutenant Dolan back in Santa Teresa, he spoke up in my behalf and defended my somewhat sullied honor. The investigating officer laboriously hand-printed my account of events, and I agreed to be available for testimony when, and if, Ray Rawson and his merry band were arrested and tried. I don't think the chances are all that good myself. For one thing, Ray has all that money in his possession, along with the 40 years' worth of contacts and criminal cunning he picked up while he was in prison. I'm relatively certain he's managed to acquire 3 sets of false identification, including passports and first-class tickets to parts unknown. Wednesday morning, when I was released, a nurse just getting off duty offered me a ride as far as the Portland neighborhood where Helen Rawson lived. I got out at the corner and walked the remaining half block. The house was dark. The back door was standing open, and I could see where miscellaneous items of clothing had been dropped in the haste of their departure. I went into the bedroom and turned on the table lamp. All the old lady's pills were gone, a sure sign she'd decamped with her son and granddaughter. I took the liberty of using her telephone, not even bothering to charge the call to my credit card. I had a dreadful time getting through to anyone. I tried Henry and got his machine again. Was the guy never home? I tried Rosie's and got no answer. I called my friend Vera, who must have gone off with her doctor husband for the long Thanksgiving weekend. I called my old friend Jonah Robb. No answer. I even tried Darcy Pascoe, the receptionist at the company where I once worked. I was out of luck and beginning to panic, trying to figure out who in the world could help me out in a pinch. Finally, in desperation, I called the only person I could think of. The line rang 4 times before she picked up. I said, "Hello, Tasha. This is your cousin Kinsey. Remember you said to call if I ever needed anything?" Epilogue. The wedding took place late Thanksgiving Day. Rosie's restaurant had been transformed by flowers, by candles, by room deodorants. Rosie in her white muumuu, a crown of baby's breath in her hair, and William in his tuxedo, stood before Judge Rainey, holding hands with tenderness. Their faces were shining. In the candlelight they didn't look young, but they didn't look that old either. They were glowing, intense, as if burning from within. Everyone seemed to be part of the promises made. Henry, Charlie, Louis and Nell, Clotilda in her wheelchair. The terms for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, in sickness and in health, pertained to all of them. They knew what loving and being loved was all about. They knew about pain, infirmity, the wisdom of age. I stood there thinking about Ray and Laura and Helen, wondering where they'd gone. I know it's absurd, but I found it painful they hadn't cared enough to stick around and see that I was okay. In some curious way, they'd become my family. I'd seen us as a unit, facing adversity together, even if it was only for a matter of days. It's not that I thought we'd go on that way forever, but I would have liked a sense of closure. Thanks, fare thee well, drop us a line someday. William and Rosie were pronounced husband and wife. He took her face in his hands, and the kiss they exchanged was as light and sweet as rose petals. Trembling, he whispered,
"Oh, my love, I've been waiting all of my life for you."
There wasn't a dry eye in the place, including mine. Respectfully submitted, Kinsey Milhone. This concludes the reading of L is for Lawless by Sue Grafton. This book was read by Mary Pfeiffer.